Today's episode is brought to you by our distribution partner, Virgil Films and Entertainment. Now, I've worked with Virgil personally, and I can tell you this is a company that champions independent filmmakers. With over 25 years of experience in film distribution and having partnered with brands like National Geographic, OWN, and Major League Baseball, their films, including the mega hot Super Size Me, the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, and the hit documentary Forks Over Knives, have landed on Netflix, Hulu, YouTube, Tubi, Apple TV, and more. They work directly with filmmakers and streaming platforms, and they offer a range of deals to fit different needs. They don't just distribute films, they elevate them. And truthfully, they're just really great people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And now, on to the show. The reason I asked you if you had talked to Steve recently, I wondered, he had been on our podcast, and it was back on June 26th, but we,
That's my birthday.
That's your birthday? He was busy with me that day. He may have come to a party for you, but in that evening, he was busy with me, and we then released the podcast later. Recently. So it wasn't that long ago. But in my personal life, it was a really interesting thing that happened because it was a very special, special moment for me. Billy Joel has been, almost the soundtrack of my life since I was a kid. I lived in Long Island and he was just, I just loved Billy Joel. And so to be able to talk with Steve and talk about this film, I saw it. I stayed up till 2 a.m. the night before watching it because HBO
didn't get it to me. Oh, my God. God bless you.
Yeah. They didn't get it to me till like the evening.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Not going to talk to him without watching it. And so I watched both both parts and, you know, was just so incredibly moved by all of it. And one of the things that was very meaningful to me was the way that Billy talked about his mother. And I loved what you guys did with how he was honest about who she was, but he was honest about both sides. He was honest about her challenges with her mental and emotional, you know, capabilities, but also, and how they harmed him, but also how she was the wind beneath his wings in a lot of ways and how she, you know, inspired him. And I loved that, that dichotomy and how you treated that. And he treated that with honor and wasn't demeaning. And I had a lot of the same issues with my own mom. And so as I watched this whole film, as with any Billy Joel song, you begin to relate to what he is going through and learn from him. And so I learned so much through your documentary. So for me, it wasn't a documentarian sitting back and kind of critiquing a documentary. I tried to do that, but but I got too engrossed as a fan and somebody just listening to your story. And so as I was talking to Steve and telling him this, explaining that that was one of the great things I thought about your film, I said a line, which is, I really hope my mom's not watching this, and explain what I just told you. And the next morning I wake up and I'm packing to go on a trip for a big surgery where I was going to be out for a few weeks. And I get a call and I hear that my mom has died. And completely suddenly and totally unexpected.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was crushing and heartbreaking. And it was crazy for me because that interview with Steve was such a highlight of my life. And so I went from this incredible, amazing night. It was at night and I woke up the next morning and I don't know. It was just almost felt like it was these bookends in some sense. And I had had this cathartic thing the night before, and was really thinking about my mom, but was thinking about the same thing Billy Joel was, the positives and the negatives of a mom who had emotional challenges and how it impacted me. So, you know, your film for me personally means a lot and it will never be forgotten. And so for me, it may have been a minute since I talked to Steve, and but it's just, it's very, very current.
Well, Christian, that's very moving.
Yeah, well.
It's very moving. And I do think that it hasn't been an uncommon reaction. Obviously, your story is extreme, and I am so sorry for your loss. Yeah. I really, like, my heart goes to you, and especially when something is sudden.
Yeah,
that can be really hard. Affecting in a way that you just don't even expect. But I will say that
4 weeks.
I will say that, God, it's still very raw, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I would say that your experience is not an uncommon thing that we've heard from people, which has been really gratifying, that they really understood and embraced the emotional arc of the film, and that many of the relationships we touched on, because obviously the parental relationships in Billy's life were paramount to who he became, and not just, you know, during his childhood and how it then affected him, but that it affected him throughout his career and throughout his life. And I think many of us, you know, can relate to that. You know, especially those of us who may not have perfect relationships with our parents, you know, these things stay with you. You know, throughout your life. And I think many of the things that you do can be reactions to that. And I think that all I'm saying is that people have really latched onto that in a lot of ways in the film, and it has affected people really deeply because they can relate to those relationships you try to unravel really for your entire adult life and try to make sense of them. And the way Billy made sense of them was through his artistry and through his music. And that was something really important that Susan and I bonded about very early on in the making of the film, first as a producer with my fellow producer, Emma Pildes, and I and Susan. The three of us have worked together for a long time, and Susan and I have worked together for almost 25 years, if you can believe that. We bonded early on about the fact that we knew that the emotional core of this story was complex, and that it was very important that, you know, we dig deep with Billy in terms of the music and the personal story and how those things related. Because I think a lot of people don't realize how autobiographical his music is. And I think that when we kind of happened upon that, Susan and I really bonded over that. And we were like, wow, this is incredible. Like, it's almost like his songs are ripped from the journal of his life. You know, if he were, you know, it was like, that's the way he processed his emotions, was through his music, through his lyrics, through his, you know, the outpouring of emotions. And that comes on a lot of different levels. Of course, some of them are, you know, super obviously, you know, personal about specific relationships. And we go into some of that in the film. And I think that people really enjoyed hearing those stories and understanding how really exactly related it was. Like, for example, like, You May Be Right. You know, people are like, how is it? That's exactly what happened in his life. And then he put it into a song. Yes, that was Billy. He really, he took, now, not that everything was exactly, what's the word? Word for word or verbatim to his life, but, you know, that's what makes an artist special, right? They're able to take these things and kind of, I think it's Elizabeth who says in the film, you know, an artist takes this and that, and they shake it up and they make magic. That's Billy, but it's really extraordinary when you start to understand the, you know, the incredible relationship between his life and his music. And whether that was personal relationships, whether those were observations he was making in his community or his friends or, you know, things that were happening. Like one song I'm thinking of right now that's not about him, but as personal as the song James, for example, which is written about a friend of his. I don't know how deep of a fan you are, so I don't know if the songs I'm thinking about are.
No, I know. Yes.
So for example, the song James, or even in the song My Life, where he talks about you know, his friend who went out to the West Coast to be, that's about a real person.
I know.
Okay, well, you know all this, but not all people do, but
no, but I mean, our audience may not, but what's amazing, I mean, you even think about the ones everybody knows, which is Piano Man. I mean,
sure.
Go to Piano Man, which everyone knows, and everyone thinks, oh, that's probably just, you know, a made up song because it's kind of so generic. But no. It actually has its roots in exactly what happened. You know, you were 100% right that you guys made the right choice in how you told it, because what's so real about his music and timeless and why it's so relatable is the fact, and you hit on this almost immediately, is that it is pulled directly, ripped from the heart of his life. And it's true. Some of those things are true for all of us. And one way or another, we can relate to the struggles of his life.
And for sure. And also relate to his vulnerability. That's the other, you know, piece of it that we didn't know going into this. And first of all, let me just say, since we are recording, that Susan Lacy sends her best and was sorry not to be on this podcast. I will do my best to represent her, but if you're ever able to get her on a one-on-one, you will certainly enjoy it. She's a wonderful storyteller and speaker. But I think one thing I would like to just talk about for a moment is how Billy did open up and begin to reveal himself. And I do think that a person like Billy Joel, or anybody who has been in the public eye for as many years as he has, and as many run-ins that he's had with the press, you know, positive, negative, everything in between, you know, he lived his life in the public eye, for better or for worse. You know, if you think about his relationship and marriage to Christie Brinkley, I mean, that entire relationship played out in the public eye. And I think that was quite difficult, you know, quite difficult for him. So all I'm saying is that he came to this process, I don't think knowing what to expect, and why should he, other than our reputation and Susan's incredible reputation as the filmmaker who founded American Masters and had made, you know, umpteen films about incredible artists, everybody from Leonard Bernstein, Bob Dylan. We made a film about John Lennon called Lennon NYC. Pardon?
Steven Spielberg.
I mean, Jane Fonda. He knew, obviously, that we had a strong body of work, but I don't think he knew how that was going to translate into reality. Right. And so I think coming into the process, he had trepidations like any artist like him would about, you know, oh, they're just going to tell the same old stories. They're just going to, you know, rehash. Why do I need to talk about these things? And I think that Susan was quite clever in the way that she approached the interviews, besides him being in front of a piano, which I know, which is, as we talk about it, as he says at the beginning of the film, it's my security blanket. I want to hide behind the piano, which is really true. I mean, what was so amazing, Christian, when we would come in to set up for the interviews, we would have the crew all around buzzing about him and whatever. He would walk in when he was ready to come in there. He'd walk in, sit right down at the piano, and just start playing. You know, well, it didn't matter. I mean, it might be classical. It might be a show tune. It might be, you know, something he heard on the radio. It might be, you know, something that was on his mind, or he would just sit down and start playing. And we would all just sort of fall into a fascination watching him, because obviously he's so talented and he can play anything that he can hear. So he would just be noodling and, you know, we would just enjoy that so much. So having him at the piano was very key in making him comfortable. But also Susan started from places that they had things in common. She started with his story about his own, you know, family's backstory in Nazi Germany, which, go ahead, you want to ask me something?
What I want to do is I want to start our podcast. So we just jumped in.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I know. I haven't even started our opening. This was our just little warm-up get to know you. So let me start our podcast. And well, this is wonderful. So we're going to start and actually we're gonna kind of start over. All right, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. If you have been looking at the title of this episode, Unlocking Icons, Jessica Levin on Billy Joel, American Masters, and the Art of the Interview, you already know that we have a distinguished guest on our show. So let's jump right in. Actually, we already have. And what we're going to do is we're going to do what all good documentaries do, is as you've been listening, we have started already with the beginning of this conversation, because we just jumped right in and began talking about the wonderful movie that Jessica Levin and her co-producer, Susan Lacy, have put out. co-director, sorry, co-director Susan Lacey just put out, And So It Goes, the story about Billy Joel's life. And so I have the immense pleasure of welcoming Jessica Levin. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Christian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, now before we get started, I did have an icebreaker to throw at you, which we don't really need, but I want to hear that anyway. So if you had to pick one Billy Joel song as your life soundtrack
you're not going to ask me that.
I am. And maybe you don't have to be the life soundtrack, but let's just say you wanted to pick one that you really love or, you know, that kind of is playing in your head all the time. Give me one.
Christian, that is one of the most difficult questions that I get. And this is because I am a lifelong fan.
You are.
And I'm glad that I was able to bring that to the table, you know, in terms of the collaboration with Susan. She came to things from kind of a bird's eye view. And we ended up meeting in the middle very much with our intellectual and emotional approach to our subject. But that's a tough one for me. What I will say is that I really discovered Cold Spring Harbor, the Cold Spring Harbor album.
Yes.
In a way that I hadn't before. I had heard it, but it wasn't really on my playlist. Mm-hmm. And I think that, there's some really beautiful songs on that.
Are you from Long Island?
I'm not. No, I grew up in Manhattan and Connecticut.
Okay.
Tri-state, you know, but my brother gave me the first album that he gave me as a gift was Street Life Serenade.
Oh, yeah.
And now let's see, that would have been in the early 80s, and that album's from 1974. But he was always sort of throwing different music at me and stuff. He was a little bit of my musical mentor early in my life. And so that was the first album I became very familiar with. And I really loved it because it had such a sweeping kind of, you know, melodic kind of epic feel to it. Mm-hmm. And it was deep, dripping with satire. And I just enjoyed it so much. And so that was my first exposure to Billy Joel. So I knew him as a true deep melodist.
Yeah.
And somebody who, there was a lot of many layers in his songs. Mm-hmm. And now when I first met Billy, I was quite proud that I was a big fan of Street Life Serenade. And I said to him, you know, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I'm such a big fan. You know, my favorite album is Street Life Serenade. And I was just so proud of myself. He's like, oh, no one ever says that, you know? And he said to me, well, that's my least favorite album. Because I was rushed into the studio and I just don't think there's very good work on it and whatever and blah, blah, blah. And I was so embarrassed. And I was like, okay, well, obviously I didn't do enough research to be able to have that conversation. But that is very indicative of Billy. He's very tough on himself. He's not a guy who sits comfortably in a place of praise. Mm-hmm. What that has to do with his own upbringing, you know, we could delve into, but that's not really a place that he's comfortable in any case. So he's always self-deprecating and he always puts, you know, humor into, you know, all of his answers and all of the ways that he relates. So, but I don't know. I think some songs that I discovered, I guess I didn't know that the song on Cold Spring Harbor was about Elizabeth, about his relationship with Elizabeth.
Let's just talk about Elizabeth for a second, because there's a lot of people that may not even know who she is. And I consider myself a big fan, and I did not know.
So Elizabeth Weber was Billy Joel's first wife and his manager. Mm-hmm. And they had a tremendous collaboration that lasted probably a decade, all the way through, Glass Houses, it probably was. Nylon Curtain, there are some songs that are about their relationship, but they were pretty much fizzling out at that point. But Elizabeth Weber, Billy fell in love with Elizabeth when they were young. I mean, young. I mean, 20 years old, probably. Yeah. And she was married to his bandmate. It was quite the scandal, and she was married to his bandmate. Now that was a marriage of convenience. She was pregnant and she had said to him, we need to get married. And so they did, but I don't think they were ever a really true love match, but nonetheless,
clearly not, because the three of them living in the house together, very quickly, she and Billy Joel became very close.
Correct. And they have been close because being, you know, Elizabeth's brother and John Small were in the Hassles. Billy replaced her brother in the band.
Right.
And the Hassles. And this is in, you know, the late 60s. So Elizabeth knew Billy all the way back. And I think we talk about in the film that she observed him, you know, very early on before they became involved and said, wow, this guy really has tremendous work ethic and he's very talented. He was certainly not Billy Joel at that point. He was just a guy from Long Island, you know, it was in a band. But they did get along and they clicked just as friends. And, you know, it developed into something more. And it was quite a heartbreak, both for him, his dear friend John Small, and Elizabeth. And they all went their separate ways at that point. And that's when Billy really, you know, sunk into a deep depression.
Yeah.
Because he just felt so guilty that he had, you know, broken up his best friend's marriage. So Elizabeth and Billy had a tremendous love, tremendous collaboration. And when they broke up, she left the scene. She left the rock and roll business. She left Billy's life. She left behind the entire Billy Joel organization. She moved out to California and basically did not speak to them for 4 decades. If you can believe that. I know it's hard to believe, but true. Elizabeth's son, Sean, had girlfriends that didn't even know that his mother was ever married to Billy Joel. I mean, it was like it wasn't a thing they talked about at all. So the fact that she spoke in this film was groundbreaking for fans, for the story.
It was remarkable. And I will tell you, one of the things that was absolutely stunning to me was how so many of his past broken life relationships were willing to come on and interview in this documentary. In some ways, it didn't happen in real life, but in some ways in the documentary, it felt like a very cathartic healing. You know, maybe had happened that they were willing to come on and speak, because they didn't speak poorly of Billy. They just talked about what it was and kind of had accepted what it was. But, you know, this kind of goes to the first big question I want to ask you, because this is no surface documentary. This documentary goes deep into the heart of a very complex person, as you said, a person who, though, is very closed. And like you said, he needs a security blanket. You've said that once already. He does not take praise well. You said that it also. Mm-hmm. So he's already, you can tell, got these defenses up.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
not only that, you can tell that this is a guy who doesn't easily talk to people or let them in, because he writes songs to deal with his stuff.
That's right? Correct.
So here you already know, and not only that, you know, we're told from the beginning of the documentary that lots of people, or maybe that was in my conversation with Steve, or my other podcast, was told that lots of people had asked him to do documentaries, and he just kind of blew them off. So that's inside info.
Yes.
I have from Steve.
Yeah.
But so now I know all of this. And so my big question to you, because what was remarkable to me was how you guys were able to make him so comfortable that he was willing to just lay his heart bare, his heart and his life. And I know personally, this is an art cultivated over time. And it's something that's learned, and sometimes it's innate by documentary filmmakers. And so I really need you to think about how to teach this to our young filmmakers as best you can.
Okay. So first of all, I want to say that, Susan Lacey did the interviews. I think it's important for me to say most of them. I did a few, but she did all the interviews with Billy.
And let's say who Susan Lacey is real quick again.
Sure. Yes, of course. Over. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. You can do
we
it.
Over in the beginning. Can, Well, I'm going to let you do a quick bio for her, just because we want to focus on what you have to tell us. You're here, and talk about, you have a company together, or you're in a company. And let's talk a little bit about that. And, you know, hopefully she'll come back on the show and we'll get into her full bio and unpack her life.
That would be wonderful. I think you would really enjoy it.
Yes,
so Susan Lacy, came onto the documentary scene by founding the series American Masters. I believe it was 1986 or 1987. And her goal in creating that series was to create a record of the body of work of American artists and to make films about American artists and to understand them in depth so that you could understand the genesis of the art and the importance and put it in context in American history and American cultural history. Now, that came in a lot of different forms. You know, it wasn't a cookie cutter series like some series are. It didn't have a narrator. It was a collective of filmmakers. She would, you know, a filmmaker might come to her with an idea. I want to do a film about Robert Capa, you know, and they would come and it would be a collaboration. And Susan would help with developing it, sometimes help with raising money. And that series ran on public television and still is on public television. And she ran it for 30 years. But it was her life's mission to create this record of American artists. So she is a person who is well steeped in American culture and arts, and many, many other subjects had trusted her, you know, prior. So if you kind of like take that as kind of your, you know, your starting point on this project, and in terms of,
and she left and started this own company. And
yes,
did you?
Course,
start,
sorry, yes. In
did you start working with her at PBS? Did you guys meet there?
Yes, yes. Okay. Well, we started working together in about 2000 or so. We our first collaboration was on a film called Joni Mitchell, Woman of Heart and Mind.
Yeah.
We bonded very early because we were both very big Joni Mitchell fans. And I came to her, you know, she needed a producer and I came to her and we just bonded. We just spiritually and emotionally and intellectually bonded over how important Joni Mitchell's work was and how important of a figure she was in that moment in time in the, you know, confessional folk movement of that moment of the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. So we made that film, you know, together. I produced, and I just produced every film she did at American Masters from that point forward in terms of her as a director. There were other films that were done that she wasn't director of that I didn't produce, but so I produced everything she directed at American Masters. And then we made a film called Inventing David Geffen.
Yes, I love that film.
I don't know if you've ever seen that, but for your audience, that film is a lot of fun and really—
It is so great. If you haven't seen it, big
It's a great ride through Hollywood and the behind the scenes of the business and the music business. And, you know, he's just a fantastic character, David Geffen. And really interesting. He was another one that was not so easy to get to open up, by the way.
Really?
Yes, but he did. And I think he was happier for it. And I think frequently this happens with the artists. They're very closed and they're concerned and they don't know. But then when they see the finished product, I think they're happy that they went there, so to speak.
Yes.
So anyway, so we made this movie, Susan directed and I produced that. And HBO suddenly showed up and said, why are you guys not making films for us? And Susan said, I don't know. Why are we? And no, it was, you know, what happened in public television, and as you know, is happening in an accelerated pace at this very moment in time, is that you have to raise money.
Yeah.
And, you know, PBS has a certain amount of money that, you know, helps to fund some of the larger series. But much of it is you have to raise the money for each film. And I think for Susan, the specter of I'm not going to have to raise money and that HBO is going to commission these films, suddenly a light went off and she was like, okay, I'm ready, you know? Yeah. And she said to me and to our other key person in Pentimento Productions, Emma Pildis, who directed a film called The Janes a couple of years ago, which was shortly after an Oscar, she came to the two of us and she said, well, I want to do this, but I'm not going to do it without you guys because we are like a family. We're a team and we're close, you know, close collaborators. So we said yes. And that was 2013, I think. And so it's been what, over 10 years.
Yeah.
So we made several films. We've made several films for HBO and it's been a really wonderful place to filmmaking home. HBO is a very artist friendly place. They're sort of, I guess their tagline is like prestige television, sort of in a way. And that was a comfortable place for us because I think they understood that we weren't just trying to churn something out, that we were trying to make things that were definitive and that were going to really go deep and where you were going to learn about these artists and these figures in a way that you wouldn't otherwise, maybe not even by reading the book.
Oh, listen, and you guys have knocked them out of the park. I mean, they could not have, you know, they bet the farm, but they, you know, made a very safe bet on you guys. And, you know, your work has just been stellar. And, you know, obviously with this film, this two-part series, I mean, it is a five-hour documentary.
And I tell you, it was longer.
I can imagine. I can only imagine. How can you do a documentary about Billy Joel and all of his songs and it not be? I just can't imagine. I can't imagine.
It was pretty epic. And then Susan actually made the decision. We've got to get this down to two episodes. But we really didn't go that much out because each episode is almost 2.5 hours.
Yes. So it is. But you know what? I watched it in succession. I told this in my other podcast. I didn't even start watching it till like, I don't know. It was very late, like 8 or 9 p.m. one night because I didn't get it till late. And it got till 11:30 and I was like, oh man, should I keep going? I couldn't not keep going. Like I just had to. It did not feel like a 5 hours.
That's a huge compliment. And each film and each piece of art that you make about an artist needs to reflect that particular story. Mm-hmm. So we don't come into films, and Susan doesn't come into films with a preconceived notion. This is going to be, you know, 90 minutes. This is going to be whatever. This is going to be how this film. We frequently are just driven by the interviews. Certainly in this case, we were, because Billy, as he went along, he really began to open up and this story arc really revealed itself by the things that he spoke about and the fact that he was able to tap into emotions that we didn't know where he was going to go. And the fact that he went there enabled us to tell that story and to tell that deeper emotional story. And you asked the question,
yes,
you know, about, you know, interviews and getting people to open up.
How did you get there? How did you get him? Because originally he basically, you know, I think he told Stephen, you know, I think he up front was like, I'm not really going to go there. I'm not really going to tell these stories.
Well, it wasn't so much that. I think that he couldn't imagine what could. Billy is just that kind of self-deprecating person where he's like, how could my life be this interesting? Who would want to hear me talk about this again? I've talked about all this stuff.
Everything's in my songs.
Everything's in my music. You know, we don't need to do this. But I think that what happened was that, first of all, Susan was very, very clever. She came into the interviews with the things that they had in common. She first explored kind of his childhood and his family backstory in Nazi Germany, which we go into in episode 2 of the documentary. And she explored that with him. And he began to really sort of open up and say, wow, you're really interested in this. This is great. And he began to almost scratch his own memory about things and begin to think about how they related to his current life in a way that I don't think he necessarily had before, or certainly hadn't on camera. And then the second interview, I think, was talking all about classical music and how his roots were in classical music. There's a tremendous story in the film that if you've seen it, you know, about how he really had a difficult relationship with his father. But when he was a child and his father was still at home, his father left the family when Billy was about 7 or 8, he was playing the Moonlight Sonata because Billy was already taking classical lessons. He started at the age of 4. And his father was by the book. You practiced. You did what Beethoven wrote. And he began playing Moonlight Sonata and he began improvising because that's what Billy would do, because he would just hear things in his head and he would just start improvising. And his father literally came down and hit him so hard that it knocked him off of the piano. Now, you know, these days, you'd probably, you know, somebody would be calling, you know, 911 or whatever, and they'd be arresting the father. Look, it was a different time. But the point is that, you know, he had this early, early, deep, deep connection to classical music. That was his foundations. And Susan Lacy has a tremendous knowledge base about classical music, and they connected on that. So that was, I believe that was the second interview. I'm not sure I'm going to remember the sequence exactly. But the point is, I think after those first two interviews, I think at one point Billy said to Susan, boy, you go deep. Hmm. And she said, yes, we do. And you do too. Hmm. You have to go deep too, if we're going to make the type of film that we want to make here. And I think that clicked a little bit with him, realizing that, you know, this wasn't going to be a surface, you know, leitmotif kind of situation. We were really going to try to explore. And Susan's goal and my goal as coming under, Susan's my mentor, I'll say that. And she's been incredibly generous with me, and all the way back to the Joni Mitchell film, sharing ideas and connecting, you know, artistically together. We felt, you know, early on that, you know, it was just so important to get to the emotional heart of this person, because this is a really famous person, almost maybe the most famous person we've ever made a film about, and was so in the zeitgeist, and so people have ideas and preconceived notions, you know, Uptown Girl, you know, Just the Way You Are, you know, this, the hits, they know him. They know, We Didn't Start the Fire. Oh, that guy, he's a pop smith, you know, and he knows how to do that. And we wanted to really try to bust that up and try to make people understand that this is a really deep, complex man. And yes, you might know these certain hits, but when you get into the deep catalog and you really start understanding where all this music came from, you have a whole new lens on it.
Well, and I think it shows you why his music is so enduring. And I mean, why my children, I have four boys all over the spectrum from 35 to 23, they all know his music. So, you know, I'm giving away my age, but I'm 58. My husband's 54, 55. And, you know, I have kids all the way down to, you know, 23. And everyone knows his music. Well, and everyone can relate and know different songs. And I think it's because of that exact reason. His life is in his stories. And, you know, it's what makes it so interesting and everlasting.
Another thing you're bringing up is that his music is very intergenerational. And the and I think what's really interesting for me, I'm not too far from your age, and people have different touch points with Billy Joel. You know, the first album they heard, or maybe they grew up listening to Moving Out and, you know, The Stranger and 52nd Street, or maybe they came in at Innocent Man, you know, and they know, you know, Uptown Girl, and they know Tell Her About It, and they know the music videos, you know, or maybe they came in at Allentown, you know, or maybe they came in at We Didn't Start the Fire, which was the 80s, and, you know, a whole different, you know, period of time. So I think one thing that's interesting is that, you know, people, in terms of the soundtrack of our lives or our generation, it's multiple generations, because he was an artist over so many decades. And I think that is one of the reasons that for some people, I think, you know, it was a revelation hearing about The Stranger in the documentary, because they only knew his later career, and they didn't even realize that he had this like groundbreaking, you know, breakthrough album in 1977. So that is another reason that I think that the film was a touch point with so many people, because they really enjoyed sort of, it's like, oh, I get it. Now I know why my parents love Billy Joel so much, you know, or, you know, now I understand why my sister, you know, went crazy for, you know, We Didn't Start the Fire, whatever it is. So, and that's a lot of fun. And I think that, you know, most everybody knows at least something about Billy Joel. He's a household name. But like I said, it was very important to us that you understand that this is a very serious musician. This is somebody who, you know, not just a serious musician, but an intellectual guy, like a really deep guy.
I used to tell my husband, because I did know music. I grew up singing and I grew up playing the piano a little bit. And I didn't know any things about his background musically. Cause you know, when we grew up, all we really had were the back of the albums or the, what we read in the tape jacket. We didn't have, you know, MTV till 82. And we didn't really, you know, we didn't watch these interviews. We had some Rolling Stone, but who read that really? We didn't really know a lot about these artists or their backgrounds, and they weren't very open. And you were lucky if you went to, you know, the big concerts and things like that. So I lived in in a small town in Mississippi. So, or was in a boarding school, you know, in New York. I didn't have those opportunities. So I didn't really know. But what I did know was like, this guy's a genius. Like I could tell there was something like behind all of his music, because he just wove things in there that I could tell. And I could hear what he was doing with his music. I didn't understand it, but I knew it was more than met what I saw on the surface. And I could, when I listened to it, I would kind of try to point it out to the people around me like, oh my gosh, you realize what he just did? But what your movie did was it showed me what it was. It showed me exactly why he was such a genius. And that's what I loved about it. I was like, oh my goodness, now I know.
No, it really, I think we did do a good job illuminating certain, you know, aspects of what, you know, the foundational kind of aspects of what makes, what inspired him. And he had such a breadth of influences. I think that's the other thing that's very interesting as a musician, a tremendous breadth. And we just talked about his, you know, foundational classical training and how his classical music fed into his deep sense of melody. And we go into that quite a bit in episode two. His producer on River of Dreams makes some really wonderful, Danny Kirchmeier makes some really wonderful observations about how he integrated, you know, classical music into pop music, which if, when he points out Uptown Girl could have been a Mozart piece, you know, he plays it, and you're like, oh, I guess it could be, you know, you're like, oh, you know, you don't really think about that, but that's how his brain works. You know, he's very melodic. He's driven by, you know, melodic inspirations. That is what, and he says, I think at one point in the film, he says, you know, the music always comes first and there's always a message in music. And it's, you know, I'm trying to pull out, you know, it's like he's going from the gut, you know, and spilling these emotions out into music.
Yeah.
And then he sort of has to almost backtrack and pull out, well, what is this about? And what am I talking about here? Mm-hmm. And if you look, we use a lot of the lyric books in the film and you get to see sort of.
That was such genius. I just loved it. Like the way that you guys used extra things to help tell the story in the lyric book was one of
Shout out to Mighty Oak who did our graphics.
Okay.
They did a beautiful job. And, you know, the documentary is a very collaborative art. You know that.
Yes.
Our editors, you know, we had three editors. We started off with an editor that Susan has worked before, Chris Liam. And then we added two other editors because it was just such a vast story. One is James Pilot. He actually works on staff at HBO. And then Stephen Ross, who cut the Warhol series. I don't know if you saw that.
Okay. Yeah. No, I did a little, I think I did. Yeah.
It's excellent. If you ever get a chance to watch the whole thing, he's a really talented. So the point is that we had wonderful collaborators, and Mighty Oak, you know, did the graphics. They came in quite late in the process, but they did the graphics, the lyrics, and, you know,
the photos was another thing that I loved how you wove in, you know, the photos of his older photos. Those were just fantastic. And I loved how you had the handwriting come off of the lyric books too. Like just so creative.
Yes. I think that people, you know, the lyrics, but in that moment it's sort of important to focus on the one thing I can think of, like one example I can think of that a song people really don't know is Where's the Orchestra, which was the last song on the Nylon Curtain. Yeah. Yes. And it's a song of really, you know, disillusionment and kind of, you know, existential kind of angst. And so we thought it was important to show the lyrics there because people don't know that song. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it and you look at the lyrics, you're like, ooh, that's pretty dark. You know, that's interesting. You know, and then he talks a little bit about it. But in those cases, when you're talking about something very specific, it's sort of helpful to sort of see the lyrics. Yeah. When he and Elizabeth are falling in love.
Oh.
And you realize that these songs are about her and the lyrics are so heartfelt.
How many of those songs are connected to her? That I was stunned. Yeah. I was just stunned. That was what was so revelatory to me. A, that she existed, but B, how many of those songs were connected to their early years together?
Well, it's a little bit of a catalog of their relationship, actually. Yeah. I mean, She's Got Away, which in my book, and you know, that it is one of my favorite songs because we started to talk about this earlier. I'm not sure we ever got there, but I really rediscovered Cold Spring Harbor on this film. And I think a lot of people did because it's kind of an unknown, you know, album. It was before he signed to Columbia Records, before right. Piano Man. And it was sort of in the singer-songwriter tradition, you know, the sort of sparse singer-songwriter tradition, confessional. And, you know, he was pouring his heart out into mm-hmm. these songs because he was heartbroken, mm-hmm. You know, over he and Elizabeth breaking up. And, you know, if you haven't seen the film, I'll just quickly, briefly, he was in love with his bandmate's wife and the two of them got together. And it was heartbreaking for all of them. And it broke up their relationship, he and John's friendship. And then he and Elizabeth broke up for a time. And at that time he was very depressed. And eventually he realized I can use these emotions and I can channel these emotions into music and into lyrics. And that is what he did. So that is why for those early songs, we felt it was very important to, you know, illustrate the lyrics because he's talking about how he was channeling his emotions and putting them into songs and into lyrics. And, I think, you know, one of his first, songs, You Can Make Me Free, written before he and Elizabeth broke up, was really about them falling in love. And then later, after they broke up, he was pining for her and he wrote, She's Got Away. And it's one of his first really true harbingers of kind of the ballads to come. She's Got Away is just such a beautifully constructed song. It has incredible bridge. You know, his voice is so pure on it. And so that's one of my favorites, I would say. I have several, but, you know, that was one that I feel like I rediscovered. And I think a lot of people did, including some outtakes that have never been heard. We used throughout the film.
I know that was just such genius. I mean, are you still there?
I am.
Okay. It froze for just a minute. So we're going to give it a second.
It's probably my fault. So we were talking about lyrics. We were talking about Cold Spring Harbor.
We were talking about your edit and just how you built this story. And that was what I think is so amazing to me. It's another wonderful thing that you guys do, which is build the story. And the story is so important in any documentary, and taking something this vast and mm-hmm. figuring out, you know, we were talking about the interviews and I don't, you know, we never really finished talking about how you get, you know, behind the mystery of this man. We talked a little bit about that.
Let me touch on that just because I know you said it was important to your viewers. Yeah. So I started by saying that Susan, you know, used a lot of common ground with Billy, I think, to break the ice and to get to know him in a place where she felt very comfortable because this is an area of expertise for her and also a place that they had commonality. Right. Her mother was a concert pianist and also she had had her family is from Germany as well. So they had a lot of they bonded over those things and were able to connect just as human beings.
And aren't they both on Long Island?
Well, yes, Susan has a house in Sag Harbor. Yeah. That's where she lives now. And so does Billy. He has a house in Sag Harbor too. Although, I think he's spending a lot of time in Florida, especially during his recovery. But, and then I think what you try to do is you try to sort of take baby steps. You know, you're not going to talk about the most difficult things first.
Right.
You know, you need to kind of do building blocks. You know, you need to do building blocks of story. You need to do building blocks of emotional things. You need to do building blocks talking about music. And, you know, so that you're building some trust. And I think that at some point, I think I said to you, you know, Susan said to Billy, said to her after one of the interviews, you know, wow, you know, you really go deep. And she said, well, you're going to have to go deep too, if we're going to make the kind of film that we're setting out to make here. And I think that, you know, feeling that you're on the same side with your artist, that your artist and you are on the same page, are on the same team, in terms of, you know, how, and by the way, the other thing about these types of films is that if the artist isn't willing to go there, you know, people aren't going to take the movie seriously. They're just not.
True. Do you tell the artist that? I mean, that's one thing I've been wondering, like, did he understand? Okay. I mean, there had to be a mental process with him. Like, okay, I understand the kind of movies they make and am I buying into this? Am I really going to go there? I mean, did you have a conversation like that with him? Like, look, if you want this to be good, I mean, how did that go?
Well, I guess I would say, Steve, said to Billy early on, Steve Cohen, who is an executive producer on the film and is a longtime collaborator of Billy Joel's and is his creative director, said to Billy, if you sign up for this movie, you have to know that you do not have control over this. I mean, I think the Billy Joel organization is very used to controlling the narrative. They control
right.
their shows. They control their lighting. They control their right. set list. They control what cities they go to. They control the messaging out there. And what I think Steve had to impress upon Billy is that this is an independent film. You don't have editorial control here, and you are not going to have control over this story. So before we say yes, you know, let's make sure that you're comfortable with that. And to Billy's credit, early on, when she met with him, she said to him, I want to know from you, Billy, are there areas of sensitivity?
Okay.
Not that she was going to stay away from them, but that she just wanted to know, you know, so that I know what minefields I'm stepping into or where you feel. And he said to her, Susan, tell the truth. The best thing you can do is just tell the truth. And that was our guiding light, which was tell the truth. And the other guiding light for us as filmmakers was it's about the artistry. And it's about what the reason we make this film is because of the music that people have connected with and people have felt so, you know, have felt so deeply. So that's the reason we're making the movie. So everything, all roads need to lead back to their artistry and to the music. And if it doesn't contribute to that, we're not going to include it.
And I talked to, you know, your staff prior, and I said, you know, I wanted to make sure we were on the same page and, you know, let you know, these are the things I'd like to talk about, but also I want to make sure I'm talking about what you want to. And one of the things that you raised was, I'd like to talk about how you made this film independently without artist control. Is that what you meant?
Absolutely. Okay. Billy or his camp had no editorial control over this film.
That seems to me it would make it more scary for Billy, like to open up even more. But
you know, like I said, I think Billy's an interesting person because he's like, how could I be that interesting? You know, I don't think he sees it from our point of view. And that's kind of the charm of Billy. And that's why we can all relate to him. And we all have the imposter syndrome, right? Where we're like, oh, you know, like, ugh, I'm probably the worst at this that there is, you know? I mean, he thinks of himself as do the work, you know, and if the work is solid, then the audience will follow. And, you know, we feel the same way about the movie. We weren't thinking about how are we going to please the fans? How are we going to please the people who don't know anything about it? We just told the story that we felt needed to be told. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really... if I were to give advice to a filmmaker, I would say, follow your heart, follow your gut, you know, try not to listen to the noise, you know, because you have to have a vision, you know, for what you think is important about a movie. And Susan and I, very early on, were like, wow, we need to reveal the person that people don't know. People know this person, but they don't know this person, you know, who's underneath. And that's the person that we want people to know and understand, because all their life of listening to Billy and, you know, hearing him and thinking, oh my God, I love this song. I love this song. There's a reason that he is who he is, you know? And it was almost like, it's kind of like one of those things. What do they say? Like if you take a bunch of lump of coal and you put a bunch of pressure on it, it turns into a diamond. He's one of those guys, you know, who almost like overcame just insurmountable odds.
Absolutely. I mean, when you hear everything that he went through and that he did to himself, a lot of times it was own self-sabotage. Yeah. Like, I just can't even imagine what he over, and look what he is still overcoming to this very day. I mean, you know, even for him to do what he did through this movie while he was still battling things, it's remarkable to me. And it goes to the character, the resiliency, the desire to, I think, inspire others. It was just remarkable. You know, you mentioned, you know, stick to the story, tell the story, you know, tell the truth. And that brings me back around to, I wanted to talk about the story, because the story is critical to the success of anything. We want to hear the story. And if it's told well, it brings us in. If it's not told well, we leave. And that's what drew me in about and made me want to sit for 5 hours in the middle of the night was the way that you told it. I couldn't leave, especially at the end of part one. I just wanted to know more. And a lot of that was the tactics that you used in terms of the different tools in your toolbox with footage that I had never seen before.
Yeah, there were a lot of nuggets. There was a lot of golden nuggets in the film. For people who don't know, they don't know, but for people who are fans and, you know, but even the home movies and the behind the scenes and the things like that, I mean, that stuff is, people love to see that. And it's because it's real and it's authentic and it's, you know, how someone lives and it's unguarded. And that's the stuff that really is revealing and makes these films universal and makes these films, you know, have an effect on people when they can relate to the person who is the central character in the film. That's the same in feature films as it is in documentaries, which is, if you cannot relate to your central character and they don't have some humanity to them that you can relate to, you know, you're not going to stick with it no matter how fantastic the music is. But I do want to say, before I forget, I wrote down, in terms of story, the music, as I've said, was our guiding principle as to how to move through the story. And obviously we were very lucky because the music is so autobiographical. So we were able to use it to you know, weave through the story using the lyrics, using, you know, hearing longer extended pieces of the music. But the other thing I wanted to bring out for your audience is that our soundtrack of the film is entirely made up of Billy Joel music.
Can you buy the soundtrack?
To end, there is a soundtrack. I think they call it an audio companion, and it is available on iTunes and everywhere. Called And So It Goes, and it is the extended versions of some of the unheard pieces that we used in the film. And I think people will really enjoy that. It also has some snippets of dialogue in it, so you can kind of listen to it. And that was Steve Cohen's brainchild. He really wanted to have an audio companion, which was really cool. But I think what's really important for your audience to know, because you may not know this when watching the film, is that the film is 100% Billy Joel music, instrumental, classical, you know, and a few interpretations, which was Susan Lacey's brainchild, which was that she wanted to take a few of his pieces of music and make some kind of adaptations. So for example, in the, in part two, in the ancestor section, where we talk about his family and their time in Germany before they fled, you know, the Nazis, we used the song Vienna, and we had two composers, guys that worked in, that actually work in Billy's band. They did a couple of adaptations. So you hear Vienna and a lot of, you hear an orchestral version. You hear a version that's solo violin. You hear a version of The Stranger with solo violin. So that helps to become the soundtrack of the film. But I think what's important about that, and we have over 110 Billy Joel songs in the film. His catalog has about 121 songs in it. We used 110 of them.
Wow, that's amazing.
So it was really important to us to weave, to just chock a block with Billy music, Billy music, Billy music. And the reason we were able to do that, this is something we were talking about earlier, is the breadth of his influences, because you have this tremendous classical music. You have this tremendous instrumental music. Take, for example, Street Life Serenade that we were talking about earlier. Sounds like a Broadway song. Sounds like a Broadway tune. You wouldn't know. I mean, here's a rock and roller, but no, here's this Billy the Kid. It's epic. It's cinematic. Yeah. It lends depth and grace and emotionality, you know, to these different sections of the film where we're really plumbing emotions of this person and really trying to understand his battles with alcoholism, his battles with trying to come to terms with his parents, his relationships with his, you know, his relationships with women. And, you know, speaking of his relationship with women, what we found really uncanny is that he's had this incredible history of all these very strong women in his life. If you think about it, he's one of the most macho kind of guys every day, Billy Joel, you know. But the truth is, his foundation has been women. His mother, you know, Roz Joel, who he wrote Rosalind His Eyes about, who is, you know, was his champion, you know, from the beginning. And yes, she was a complex and troubled woman, and Billy had tremendous sympathy for her, although I'm sure it wasn't easy to live with at the time he was growing up. But, you know, Christie Brinkley, Elizabeth Weber, you know, his current wife.
Yes.
You know, these are foundational to who he is and who he has become. And he trusted two women to make his film. You know, to make his
strong
story,
women.
Tell his
and
story.
Let me just say, I have read so much about you and Susan. And the more I read and the more I get to know you, I am just stunned and blown away. So talk about, you know, not strong, accomplished, brilliant women. Yes, he chose them. And it's just so interesting. You're right. He does. And it has to go back to the fact that his mother did raise him and his sister almost solely on their own. And what I thought was interesting, going back to story, is that you didn't tell the story linearly.
Nearly.
That's what I'm looking for. I really liked that. I liked it that you did not do that. Although at one point I was thinking, now, wait a minute. We haven't heard really about the dad. And guess what? You told the story. You started in on his dad. And I was
Right.
So
first of all, I wanted to say that Susan had a very... It's hard to not tell these stories linearly. It is hard to do that. You have to find the touch points and the places to jump back. And Susan had a vision early on that she, two really important things. She wanted to go back to childhood when he returned to New York from California to form his New York band. That was the juncture at which we talked about his childhood. That was during the Turnstiles era. And that was really important to her. And the other really important non-linear piece was when he wore the yellow star on stage
right
after Charlottesville.
Right.
And at that point, he jumps back to, I am a Jew and I will always be a Jew. And then he jumps back to telling the backstory, you know, about
and he was older too when, you know, he was older too when he reconnected with his dad and, you know, there was, you know, kind of more understanding almost. So here we are learning.
Yeah, it was still really heartbreaking for him though, though I don't think he dealt with that for a long time. And I think, you know, if you, in the film, we do try to paint the portrait of his current relationship with his half brother, Alexander Joel, who's a quite accomplished opera conductor in Europe and in Vienna is where he lives. But I think that, you know, there are pain points there. Mm-hmm. And I think we try to understand how that relationship affected his music. And I think that was where, what we were going for, not just the cataloging of the pain and whatever, but how that affected his music. And I think I'm going to paraphrase, but I think he sent a note to Susan after the film was finished. And he said, thank you for so beautifully connecting the dots of my life and for making me understand why I did what I did.
Oh my goodness. I was going to ask you how he responded. How beautiful is that?
He didn't see it till it was finished. And I think Susan was blown away. We were all blown away. And I think that it was his relationship with his father, while he always knew it was important. And I think he says at one point, you know, when my father died, I just, you know, I kind of freaked out, you know, because I was like, hey, I'm never going to have that relationship with my father. And, you know, I think it dawned on him like that's going to be water under the bridge. And I think that was quite a painful. I had a very similar situation with my own father. He had dementia and he died. And we had a difficult relationship. And when someone like that passes, you realize like, wow, like this is it. You know, we just have to bury that because, you know, we're never going to work it out, you know? And I think that was the realization he had. And I think that, you know, he had some pain point there. But his current wife, I'm going to give her a lot of credit. She's an incredibly strong person. an incredibly strong supporter of Bill. And as he says in the film, oh, you like me for me. You weren't impressed with the music. Maybe she just likes me, you know? And I loved that because it's like, you know what? People like Billy had their guard up because it's like, you know, you think I'm just a guy who's, you know, full of, you know, top 40 hits, you know, you don't care about who the person is under that. But Alexis, you know, she wanted to go there. And so I think that is what the foundation is of their relationship. So it makes it quite different than the others. And she was very there for him when he went through that, when he went through the pain of his father passing. So I'm going on too long. I am so sorry.
No, please. This is just so beautiful. I mean, you've really answered a lot of questions that I was going to ask anyway, and really told me, you know, what we needed to know about the storytelling or about how to answer questions. What we haven't gotten to is I wanted to know more about you.
Oh,
I don't know if you have time for a few more questions.
I have, you know, maybe another 5 minutes. And okay. So,
well, why don't we do this? We'll have you come back another time. And I'm going to ask you real quick. We have a special segment on my show called DocuView Deja Vu. I don't know if they told you about this.
Okay, no.
This is where we ask our guests to come with a documentary that they would like to recommend. So if you have a second to think about that, I'm going to introduce this segment. All right, everybody. Now it's time for everybody's favorite segment, DocuView Deja Vu. All right, so here we are in our favorite segment. Do you have a documentary that you've seen recently or that's your favorite documentary or that inspired you a long time ago that you want to share with us?
Wow, I feel really put on the spot. The only one that's coming to mind right at this second was that documentary I recommended earlier, the Warhol documentary.
Okay, tell me why. Tell me about the Warhol documentary.
Well, the one thing that I really liked about it was that it was another movie that really reveals a person and tries to kind of understand the motivations and the the inner workings of an artist. And Warhol was a very complicated, very complicated person, not transparent. Mm-hmm. Whereas Billy Joel, you know, Warhol certainly lived his life in the public eye as well, but he was always a character. And, you know, so it was very interesting to see how the filmmakers were able to get beneath the surface and really understand. He created an entire cultural revolution in his moment in time. And to understand where the impetus for that came from was really fascinating. And I liked the fact, I think it was on Netflix, and it was four parts and each part was maybe about an hour. And I kind of liked that format because each sort of, you know, each chapter kind of builds on the last chapter.
Right.
Okay. If I had spent some time thinking more about it, I'd probably get come up with something else.
No, it's a great one. We'll go with that one. Also, everybody, I didn't get a chance to read Jessica's bio, but you know what? You can go on the website for her production company. And why don't you give us the website address so that people can go and visit?
Sure. PentimentoProds.com.
Yes.
So PentimentoProds.com. And you'll find all of our latest news, what we're working on, you know, what the reviews, you know, past projects. You know, we have a strong body of work, and then Susan has a strong body of work prior to even starting Pentimento Productions, which we also have a lot of information about. But please come and check us out. We also have Instagram, Pentimento Productions. So you can always follow us on Instagram so that you can see what we're up to. We try to keep it up to date, but you know, as filmmakers, you have so much to do. You know, managing the social media is, you know, maybe above my pay grade, but we're trying. And thank you so much, Christian, for having me on. And I hope you get a chance to talk to Susan in the future.
We will work on it. Thank you so much for coming. And everybody, thank you so much for listening. This has been Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Hey, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Documentary First Productions, and we need your support so that we can keep preserving history. If you could go over and grab some merch or watch our films at documentaryfirst.com, you'll help us keep making awesome documentaries and sharing the stories that matter, and also bring amazing filmmakers and their wonderful films to the world. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for visiting documentaryfirst.com.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.